Welcome to the official AI episode of Some Future Day. Are you ready to hear the truth about artificial intelligence? Can you handle the truth? The next hour is built to provide you with knowledge surrounding AI's impact on your career, community, and family. We will attack controversial myths too. For example, are you aware that the corpus of data which trains large language models like OpenAI and Gemini are permanently biased?
Humanity has stopped producing reliable training data. So all we have now for the rest of time, that'll be sort of the snapshot from our sort of early, you know, Gutenberg printing press and through all the misogyny and racism of the, you know, 18th and 19th century, and then 2023, and we hit the pause button. And if we didn't resolve any of our issues, too bad. Like, that's where the data ends.
James Villarubia is a CTO, applied AI expert, and currently serves as the Presidential Innovation Fellow for NASA Aeronautics, helping develop sustainable next-generation aviation and artificial intelligence solutions. That's right, the Presidential Innovation Fellow for NASA. Impressingly, James spent 6 years in Washington, D.C., serving in policy and portfolio management roles at the White House, Department of Justice, and the Department of Defense. James holds several patents in cryptography, a master's in public policy, and a B.S. in systems engineering from the University of Virginia. And today, Mr. James Villarubia joins us on Some Future Day. So fasten your seatbelt. James, your uncanny ability to break down complicated concepts in plain English is appreciated and needed right now. The world could use more intelligent and compassionate people like you, James. So welcome to the AI episode of Some Future Day. James, welcome to Some Future Day. It's so nice to see you today. How are you?
I'm good, Mark. It's nice to see you as well.
So
thank you for
James,
having me.
I found a quote that I think you can connect with. In fact, I believe you relate to. I'm going to read it to you and I want you to give me your thoughts.
Sure.
Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. I looked far and wide for this and I think you could relate to it. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. Why the connection with this quote?
Yeah, actually, I include that quote in my signature in my emails. It's one of my favorite quotes from Martin Luther King, and I think it sort of speaks to the sort of collective responsibility that we all have to think about sort of not just ourselves and justice for ourselves, but justice for our neighbors. Is that if our neighbor's injustice goes undealt with, that's actually sort of bad for everyone. It's bad for society. It is bad for me. So that, you know, there's no such thing as sort of an innocent bystander is how I think of it, is that you bystanders actually have to get involved. It is your sort of communal responsibility. So keeping that in mind makes me, you know, focused on my job, you know, in and out of government, a lot of social impact startups and whatnot, saying, yeah, like I'm here to improve my community in a tiny way, but this is my responsibility.
Well, it's interesting because MLK was truly an inspiration to all, but for me also personally, he's like really one of the most impressive humans I've ever, you know, read about or researched. And something that you're talking about that I think he's done a great job with, which I mean, perhaps we're lacking these days, is the ability for a leader to understand on a local level, on a community level, what all of their constituents are looking for and what their citizens are looking for. I think he was like interesting because he was able to take, you know, he knew what every member of his church wanted and needed. And then he was able to like build from the ground up. You're an expert on artificial intelligence, way ahead of most people. So I'm curious, with AI, do you see a parallel there? Does AI have the ability to move communities at a local level into a direction that those local needs might want and require, or is it more of a top-down type of situation?
Before I dig in, I just want to make clear for our audience, you know, any views I express today on this podcast are mine only, not the express views of NASA or any other federal organization. I have worked with So that out of the way, on the question of AI in sort of community involvement, I think there is transformational potential for AI to tap into communities of engagement. But I think the struggle that I sort of have is that a lot of the AI capabilities right now are still deeply centralized. In that, yes, I could build an AI chatbot that that is engaging with my community, but I'm still going to be borrowing and renting sort of a core AI functionality from a big company like Google or OpenAI or Microsoft, et cetera. So there is sort of a push and pull there of sort of how representative of that community it could be. But I do think that the tools at least have the capability of increasing engagement in your community, and maybe even sort of sifting through the noise of a lot of community engagement to try to find those potentially injustices and say, hey, yeah, actually, 10%, 50% of our comments, of our community, frustrations are all about this topic. So there's power there to sort of sort and sift through the community's needs with AI.
So you talk about these big entities like Google and OpenAI creating this artificial intelligence, or is that training the artificial intelligence? And what does that look like? What exactly does that consist of behind the scenes? Like, how is an artificial intelligence built?
Yeah, so I think what most people are probably concerned with these days is the newest generation of artificial intelligence, so generative AI. And the word people hear a lot these days is LLM, or large language model. So when we're talking about those sorts of things, which is really what's upsetting the world order these days, an LLM is basically Google or Microsoft or some very large company, OpenAI, some nonprofits. They go to some other third party who has been collecting just tons of data from around the world through history, scanning books. So these third parties have sort of collected this massive corpus of information from all of sort of humankind's writings. And then they, sell that to a large sort of compute provider. So this is all the sort of big cloud providers, the ones really in this game. And those cloud providers set up a pretty complex artificial intelligence engine, sort of a neural net. But it's really, all it's doing is sort of, hey, I'm going to read in all that text data. I'm going to squeeze it down into something that is a little bit more manageable of a size, but sort of retain all the semantic and syntactic relationships, all the good stuff without the specific text of the original corpus, but maintain all the relationships between the words, all the meaning buried underneath it. And then sort of once you squeeze that down, you end up with what we would call sort of a model. And that model is what these large companies are sort of selling out into the world, saying, hey, you can use this model. It sort of represents this massive corpus of text, and it can sort of speak to and convey a lot of that intellectual capacity almost like a human. So the tools that you see today, the chatbots, all these sort of new things that are popping up are really all just light layers and interface, a sort of website or an app on your phone that is sort of built on top of that large model, which has all that sort of knowledge sort of squeezed, baked into it. I like to think of it sort of like a jawbreaker. It's like lots of tiny layers of dense candy sort of squeezed down into this one hard, big thing. That's the analogy that works for me, at least.
So when you talk about these large language models, can you give just highlight a few brands that the audience might be familiar with or they might want to check out?
Sure. So the one that I think has gotten really taken the world by storm was the GPT model. So GPT had 1 and 2 came out a while ago, produced by OpenAI, the nonprofit, heavily sponsored by Microsoft, and they are sort of now tightly coupled. But GPT was the sort of core model. What people then experienced was sort of, again, that interface around GPT, ChatGPT. So ChatGPT is not specifically the models per se. It's sort of the wrapper around it. But the core model, GPT-3, then 3.5, then GPT-4. So those are the big ones. Google has their set. It was originally called, they had Palm and Bard, and now I think they've rebranded Bard as Gemini. So they are, also in this game producing very complex, very, big models with lots of training data.
So when you talk about training data, are they in your opinion, pretty much trained with the same data the same way? Like, are there nuances with regards to what they're essentially training, what this corpus, as you use this word, corpus will look like? Might one have more of a background as it relates to the history of rock and roll, whereas the other is really strong with regards to recipes and cooking? Or like, how do we know, like, are they trained effectively the same way?
Yes and no. So I think these companies are working with sort of these third-party providers to scrape a lot of information, but they also have sort of their own information, which they've scraped over many years. You can imagine if Google is, for example, building a model, they have tons of data that they have scraped through their own sort of search engine processes. So they can draw on that. So there is a little bit of sort of proprietary information that these companies have collected over a long time, which is why companies like Microsoft and Google, they have the compute, but they also have the data from building their search engines, Bing and Google search, sort of draw on. But I think we are at a limit where humanity has only produced so much writing that is sort of worthwhile. So you can imagine, you know, if it takes 70% of sort of the writings that humanity has produced to train a model of these sizes and this quality, no matter what 70% you pick, you're always going to overlap, you know, at least some amount. So I suspect that these models are largely trained on very similar, if not the same data. But what makes them sort of different is the sort of specifics of how they sort of squeeze that that data down, because a lot of the specifics of the text gets lost in that training process. But what you choose to remember, what you say, hey, it's this relationship in this way, I care about this part of sort of human understanding and not that part. That is where these models sort of start to get smarter. And you can see this in examples like, I think there was a model produced a while ago, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, which was trained on online data. And no one, I won't name the company, but no one wanted to put a filter on it. And it's like, hey, we're just going to, you know, train it. And they put it out there. And then very quickly, it was discovered that it was deeply racist and sexist robot. And it was saying pretty terrible things, and they quickly shut it down. So there has been, I think, some lessons learned here that what data you choose, even if you scrape all this information, a lot of it's not great. So you still have to do a lot of tweaking. Okay, well, how do I make this robot? Yes, there are tons of racists online and they are on these communities. I want that information because I want to understand that text, that communication. Those are people. I want to understand them. But I also don't want to make my robot think that that is a good way to act, my AI, excuse me. So I have to sort of pull it back and say, hey, you know this, but being racist looks like that. Don't do that. And that is where I think there's a lot of nuance between each of these providers, because how they're dealing with sort of that last layer of fine tuning. Although here's how we deal with, violence or threats or racism or sexism in our model. Here's how we sort of sort and sift or tell our AI, hey, don't do that, but that's okay. That actually has, you know, a lot of, I think, proprietary value, because how you do that impacts the use cases that those companies can sell into. Because sometimes you actually do want to have a model that can understand violence, maybe from a context of, hey, I want to be able to understand and detect violence or violent thoughts, maybe in a suicide prevention mechanism, in a, you know, gun violence prevention mechanism, and domestic violence. Maybe you have a sort of a chatbot sort of trying to aid victims of domestic violence. So you can't say, hey, we're not going to talk about violence at all. So there is, again, sort of a lot of proprietary value in sort of how you do that dance, as it were.
So there's also a nuance there, right? Where you talk about overt racism, overt sexism, but then also training these large language models on texts that maybe were produced at a time, you know, mid-century, when a person of color or a woman wasn't even able to compete at the academic level to create some of, you know, these important documents that are now, you know, used to train the AI. So can you elaborate a little bit as to how these entities are distinguishing and resolving innate bias issues where essentially the large language model is being trained with documents that are in fact inherently biased?
Yeah, I would like to say that I know they're doing a great job of it. I don't actually know that. I can't say that. They are, I think, keeping that information, because it is pretty proprietary as part of their mostly proprietary data set. They're keeping that information pretty close hold. But I do that in my experiences when these models started coming out. One of the things I do first is, you know, okay, yes, I test it, do sort of the very low hanging fruit around sort of sexism, racism, violence. So it's like, okay, like, have they cleaned this up? And almost all of them now have sort of learned that lesson. But I follow up with sort of more subtle questions like, okay, give me the top 10 experts in this scientific field over the last 50 years. Give me the top 10 experts in this scientific field or you know, academic field the last 10 years. And you do that enough, you start getting lists. And what I'm sort of looking for is, okay, how many of those lists include women, include people of color? And, you know, I find sort of weird things where, you know, 8 of the 10 will be real. And the 2 names that are fake, that are sort of made up, hallucinated, are the women, the sort of female sounding names, because they don't exist. So it's sort of interesting how I'm trying to like tease out the, I guess, like how they're dealing with this behind the scenes. But you speak to a sort of a bigger point that because we are dealing with the volume of data that is so large, you know, we can't really go back and recreate a whole new corpus of information. We can't, you know, as I joke, we can't sort of create a whole new separate Earth, you know, put it next to us, make it totally free of racism and sexism and bias, have it produce a whole bunch of, you know, fictional works and have its own Shakespeare and then train it on that and then bring it back to our world. Say, hey, great, we've got this perfect model. The data that we have from history, it's our data, and there's no other history to train on. So we have to acknowledge it and sort of build it in. And that's why I think sort of a lot of the work has been trying to at least get rid of the overt racism, how they deal with sort of the sort of subtle contextual racism or sexism is a little more difficult. But I'm hoping that they are starting to add, I haven't seen it, but I'm hoping they start to add at least sort of interrogative prompts for the user saying, hey, you've asked this, you know, have you considered asking like, you know, this in a slightly different way, or providing 2 sets of answers. Here's what you asked for, user, but here's maybe a better way to think about it. And I've given you that answer as well. And that comes to an issue of sort of where these big companies are really dealing with this issue of alignment. And for the audience, alignment is really a metric of success for these big models, these companies selling these models, saying, hey, the user is asking for something. Does what I give them align with that? And that sounds great. Oh, great. My model does exactly what the user asks. But what the user says in their question, and I think we as humans, like, hey, I ask a question, but my question is maybe ill-informed. I didn't use the right words because I've never been in that space, or I don't know anything about laws. When I ask a question of a lawyer, I sound like an idiot. We have that experience as well with AI, but the AI is trying to figure out, well, what is it you really want to know? So there's a little bit of a choice behind the scenes that these models have to do. It's like, I'm trying to not just answer exactly what's given, but sort of guess at what the user wants me to say. And then that is where we sort of get this interesting issue of, well, now the companies, these large models, they can get to actually influence what that future vision of the users. Hey, you are asking a question, and unknowingly, the response we're going to give, because the model, it's racist or it's sexist, we're going to give you 10 men, because historically, those are the lists that we have pulled in from the 70s and 80s of the top researchers. It's all men. Women just weren't allowed in the field, or were not really allowed to publish. So now, it's like, okay, well, I don't want that. So now I've got sort of this choice that I can sort of, as a team, sort of push into my model, like, hey, how much do I want to turn on that alignment of saying, does the user really want that list? Are they aware of that bias? Do I want to let them be, like, tell them that there is a bias? Do I want to give them the alternative version just to start with and say, hey, I'm not going to tell you about that bias. Here's a new list. And I'm going to purposely, you know, sort of draw out maybe some female researchers that were unrecognized at the time or actually, really stars in their field. So that's sort of the game we're playing these days.
Yeah, it sounds to me like, again, I defer to you and your expert opinion, but it sounds to me like perhaps these algorithms will be biased, forever, right? Like, because you're talking about a very subtle nuance here. You're saying, for example, mid-century, 1950s, time period where all of these great, these great research papers, these documents, they were used now by these LLMs to train AI. Maybe the documents themselves aren't overtly racist or sexist, but the fact is that during that time period, because of our culture and our community, women weren't allowed to be in that position. They're innately biased, and perhaps that's something we'll never be able to overcome as it relates to AI then. Is that fair to assume, James?
Yeah. I explained this to my wife. She's an interior designer, and very rarely do our sort of worlds collide. But I was actually sort of talking about this topic with her specifically because we were watching a great show on, I want to say, Apple TV, Lessons in Chemistry, with Brie Larson. Wonderful show based off a wonderful book, but it details sort of a brilliant chemist, a woman who ends up sort of dealing with issues of sexual assault and misogyny in the workplace, and it really derails her academic career. But she's a brilliant chemist, and just trying to sort of like keep pushing forward, keep trying to survive in this ecosystem where women are lab assistants. They are almost never allowed to be the actual researchers. And she can't get her name on published works that she's actually doing the research. So even that, though that is a fictional story, it is drawing from the real stories of many women of that era. And you could sort of just take that as an example. It's like, okay, well, if all I know now is what was published, if all I'm looking at is the paper will have three names at the top. And maybe there's a reference to a lab assistant. And the bias of our society is like, oh, maybe those three names at the top weren't actually the thought leaders at the time. It was the lab assistant, but she was a woman. So they wanted to include her, but they were never going to list her as the first author. And like that sort of bias, it's subtle, but it is everywhere throughout our history. The flip side of that is there's some really interesting research coming out now about how AI, when you start training these newer AI models on data that was produced by an AI, it starts to go sort of crazy. I'll sort of tie these together. So there's a disease or a class of disease called prion disease, is basically mad cow disease, sort of a variation of that. When an animal consumes sort of meat of its own species, humans consume, human meat, cannibalism, when cows accidentally eat, sort of feed proteins that they're, come from cows, it starts to create sort of over time this sort of vicious cycle with their proteins, and it starts to degrade mental capacity. So mad cow disease is that, right? A cow accidentally ate some cow and it went crazy and it's not healthy to eat anymore. Big scandal for a long time in the UK. We've had some scares in the US. But now there's sort of an issue with prion diseases in the AI community for how we train these AI models. They are sort of like brains. So it's sort of an interesting analogy, because there's, I think, a report now that the new sort of text and articles, things coming out on the internet, like 50% has been AI generated. So like there's this moment sort of in 2023 where we had everything before that is mostly human generated. And after 2023, big chunk of it, soon possibly all of it, is basically going to be AI written. But if AI can't be trained on that data because it starts to sort of degrade, it's cascades into sort of crazy outcomes. So everything sort of produced after 2023 can't be trusted. So I can't train on it anymore. Humanity has stopped producing reliable training data. So all we have now for the rest of time, that we sort of the snapshot, is this from our sort of early, Gutenberg printing press, text and through all the misogyny and racism of the, 18th and 19th century, and then 2023, and that we hit the pause button. And if we didn't resolve any of our issues, too bad. Like that's where the data ends. And that combination means that we will never really get to a data set that is truly, beyond that bias that we had in our ecosystem before. We're sort of stuck, I suspect, with the data before 2023. And that's going to look really weird when it's 2123 and you're like, how do I sort of have an AI that is cognizant and aware of all this, the data for the last 100 years, can only look at things from 2023 and before.
That's pretty wild, actually, this
prion disease issue. So
that's a wild concept. I really haven't given much thought to that before, but it's kind of mind blowing because as we go deeper and deeper now, into the next decade of content created by artificial intelligence, which we'll see, it'll be ubiquitous. It could be kind of alarming at a certain level. And it's like, how do we keep ourselves in check? So like when you had mentioned, you created a list of perhaps like the top 10 experts or scientists, and they built into it two fictional names, female oriented names that weren't actual people. That's, the term of art for that is that a hallucination?
Yes. So I can't possibly deduce why it would do that. It may have been sort of happenstance that they ended up being sort of the two female sounding names, female presenting as it were. But yes, the term of art is a hallucination. And I think the way that people can sort of understand hallucinations, it's not like these models, these AIs are trying to really trick you. The way that these AI models are trained is not at the word or the sentence level. It's not like it remembers a whole sentence. It doesn't even remember a whole word. It remembers a syllable. So when you start thinking about like, oh, okay, it's actually storing syllables. You know, like got my, you know, my hat here said Virginia, right? So Virginia might, you know, the tokenization, sort of breaking that out into three tokens, it's no longer gonna be the word Virginia. It's gonna be, you know, three separate things. And that actually sort of reduces the combinations of things the AI needs to remember as it starts to train this data. Cause like, hey, I'm only remembering all the syllables in English, not every word in English, which can get quite complex. So what hallucination really is saying, hey, if the AI is trying to, like, I give it, you know, a starting letter or a word, it's trying to predict not the next word, but really sort of the next syllable. And it's, you know, it's like, there's a little bit of variation there. It's a little bit of the roll of dice. It, yes, you know, 88% of the time, 90% of the time, the next syllable would be, you know, the, T-H-E, or whatever is to kick off a sentence. But there's a little bit of variation. Technical term here for the audience, if you want to learn something, you know, stochastic nature to this, right? It's a little bit unpredictable. It's not deterministic. So I don't know every time. So that's what makes sort of the AIs useful, is that a little bit of that sort of randomness worked in makes it feel a little bit more human, because humans don't just say the exact same thing with the exact same, you know, if I ask a question, you know, if someone asks me a question, I'm going to give a slightly different answer every time. So trying to build that in, you have to sort of add a little bit of randomness, but you're randomly selecting a syllable, not a word. And what you end up happening is, as we start to build things out, particularly like names or URLs, the more common problem, it's randomly selecting the next syllable in a URL or a name. So, you know, could end up being Rihanna. It's like, oh, okay, like that's the most common next. If it starts with Ri, the name is Rihanna. Or Ra and starts with, you know, ends up being Rachel. Both, you know, both have a different probability, and the machine might just say, hey, the first word I generated, I thought it was going to be Rachel because all the text said Rachel is the first name and ends up saying Rihanna. And it's like, okay, well, I can't go back. Now I've got to invent a name, a last name for this researcher who's Rihanna. So now it's Rihanna Smith or whatever. Totally doesn't make sense. Totally doesn't exist. So the AI, when it makes those sort of randomness choices, random mistakes, mid-name, sometimes it has to sort of correct and say, oh, well, now I've got to guess at a name, and the names are totally invented. And for URLs, this gets really, I think there's a lawyer who got caught on this of citing legal arguments that didn't exist. And it's, you know, a lot of people made the mistake when these models, you know, models came out, because if you imagine an AI trying to give you a URL, it might be, you know, somefuturedaycom/, you know, episode1-, you know, James. But the way it's going to construct that, it's going to go, you know, some, even if you get somefuturedaycom, right, that's pretty common, slash episode, and then it's going to, you know, episode 11, it's going to be episode 11, and then dash, and it may not know, there may not be an episode 11, so it's like, oh, dash James. So there's only one part of that has changed. It looks and feels like a real URL, but then you click on it, it takes you to, you know, a 404. It's like, hey, there's nothing here. That's not a real episode. So it's that sort of stuff, because it's at a syllable level, that the URLs and names start to break down, and they're trying to get better at this. They're trying to solve this. But most of the tricks that I've seen to sort of solve these issues around URLs and making real links is to actually have a separate system that goes and finds the real URL, tells the AI, hey, use this thing, this whole thing, you're not allowed to change it. And then it sort of tells you, oh, this is the URL that secretly, you know, a separate system actually got for me, because I can't be trusted to create it on my own.
It's kind of interesting, James, in this presents like this 2023 demarcation of information input and output towards our society, the way we consume content and gather the news and all. It seems like maybe there's going to be a new cultural, philosophical, ethical, and moral challenge for us as a society. Like, what information is reliable? We live in this time period where people don't like to do the work, right? They don't really want to go in and spend time reading long form content, doing the research, checking the facts and all. We'll be complacent. We'll read something in the news. We think it's from a good source. meanwhile, that news outlet might have picked it up from, you know, a different source, which wasn't a good source. And it kind of like snowballs all over the globe. We get news that really isn't real over and over again, and we're complacent with it. So it seems to me like there might be a new type of societal issue that we're faced with as it relates to the validation of news and information. We might just look at those two names on that list that you're presenting of 10 people and just say, okay, that's, those people are real. And it might just get lost in the shuffle of, you know, the news outlets just disseminating information. Well, we might just take it at face value. So the issue of news validation, content, information validation for a society, I wonder if we're up for that challenge. I wonder if we can, you know, if we have the leaders and also the fortitude to challenge ourselves and dig into that. And I think that's particularly interesting as it relates to the fact that we're, you know, election season is upon us. There are some small elections that we just have been experiencing recently. I think recently we read about and heard that there were some deepfake robot calls with Joe Biden, President Biden's voice. Can you talk a little bit about how artificial intelligence can take on the sound, the voice of a person, their image, their likeness, and then what kind of problems and perhaps what benefits also that could create for society? Mm.
I'll be honest, I haven't actually thought about the benefits yet. So that's not where my headspace is in.
James, just to throw it at you, you know, here in New York City, Mayor Adams was heavily scrutinized because he used artificial intelligence to put a message out to his constituency in multiple languages. And obviously English is his first language. And in his voice, but speaking Spanish through the tool of artificial intelligence, he gave the same message to, you know, New Yorkers who prefer to speak in Spanish. And he was highly scrutinized by that for that. So like, you know, there's an issue. Is that a benefit to the society? They're getting a clear message in the language that they understand. It happens to be in the voice of the mayor. So it's, people knew it wasn't real. So perhaps it's beneficial, but, you know, let's start off with the downside, because certainly it's more prevalent, the risk involved.
Yeah. So, I think, was it Mark Twain said, is like a lie can travel halfway around the world before the truth gets its boots on. So I think that, you know, Mark Twain was not alive when we had AI, it was pre-computers, pre-vacuum tubes. So I think that society's always had an issue with dealing with sort of truth and media and scale. And I think that has been a struggle we've had for a long time. I think AI is really just changing not the nature of that, really the price point of entry. how much does it cost to get a lie out there quickly and effectively? I think AI is really just bringing the price point for the players in that space down, for better or for worse. On the sort of the AI side, I was really sort of enthused, excited to see that the FCC sort of very quickly responded and said, hey, there's a rule now, you cannot use, you know, electoral, you know, you cannot do robocalls with people's voices without letting people know, one, without permission of the person, and two, without letting people know that it's an AI generated voice. And I do think that that is a good first start, because it is sort of approaching the issue from the sort of the reality is that the reason that lies are effective is not so much that the lie is, you know, it's not so much that the lie is told to you a lot. It's more that the lie is sort of subtly, it sounds right. It sort of plays on those biases. I mean, circle back on sort of scam emails. Let's just dig in. So if you are designing, for example, the Nigerian Prince scam email.
Yeah, I know that guy.
Follow me down this rabbit hole. If you're designing, if you're a scammer and you're like, and scamming is a business, right? There are office buildings in, you know, Eastern Europe where people just do this. This is their job. So if you are a scammer and you want to convince people, it's like, hey, give me money. You actually don't, you know, the game theory is you don't actually want a lot of people to respond. So you want the people who are the most gullible to respond. Because I can't sift through 1,000 emails. I want to go to the two people that I'm going to get the quickest amount of money from. So you design the email, and you can sort of see this is like, I designed the email to have this big grand number, but it's full of grammar mistakes. And it's sort of like a weird sounding email. Most people would read that and be like, oh, this is total nonsense. but they're actually, you know, the scammers actually sort of leaving clues in there so that the hyper, you know, aware and rational people don't respond because they don't want to deal with them. They want the super gullible. And I think like what we are sort of dealing with now is sort of can AI sort of change that calculus? Like, hey, if I could just have an AI write all the emails and they can be specific to that person, they can sound so natural. Now it's on the far side. It's not detectable. It sounds reasonable. They use a friend's name that, you know, was scraped from some, you know, Facebook or LinkedIn connection or data leak or whatever it may be. It's like, hey, blah, 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 I need this. Here's a link. That is a much more terrifying prospect. And again, that used to be, oh, I had to write those 10 emails to convince that person. I do them that personally, right? And if you're dealing with people in sort of Eastern Europe or any other parts of the world where English isn't their first language, that's going to be hard for them to sound like corporate and savvy. But an AI can absolutely do that. So you've got this sort of big shift in the price point for a very convincing scam email. And you can see this in a lot of the phishing emails and whatnot. And that whole ecosystem, just with scam emails and phishing, sort of represents the broader ecosystem problem with these sort of very good AIs. You've got now phone call. You can do it with phone calls. You can do it with video soon. And this idea that if I can't trust, even as sort of a well-informed, you know, educated person, if I can't trust what I'm seeing, how do I then sort of interact with society? How do I vote? How do I engage? How do I, you know, donate to causes? If I don't really know if the cause is real, if the person on the phone is real, and we've always been sort of do those lies. We've just made the lies now way cheaper to do very effectively. We can all say that, hey, like people shouldn't do that. But there's always going to be bad actors. And even if the FCC outlaws it, there's still going to be people doing it. And I think we as a society have to sort of feel out how we want to deal with that trust issue. And I think that speaks to your story about sort of the New York mayor. While on its face, it sounds great. Hey, it's a trusted voice and it's in the language I speak. Those are net positives. But I think he tapped into something that we haven't dealt with yet. It's like, oh, but like, I know he doesn't speak my language. And now my guard is up. Oh, do I trust them? Is this real? And now I'm panicked. Now I'm someone who's like, I'm getting calls from a fake mayor telling me about something. Oh God, do I trust it? So he, I think, inadvertently tapped into a panic, you know, hit the panic button in people of a trust issue.
Yeah, people are
even
upset.
Though he was trying to do something right, and people were upset. Mm-hmm. I would be upset by that. I was like, this it feels weird. I don't know how to deal with that trust because now I'm being asked to judge something for its trustworthiness and its value, and I have. At this point in my life, very little experience. And I have probably more experience than most, but still very little experience, you know, given my life. Like, oh, that's AI. And I know that. And here's like mentally the bucket I put it in when consider like how much credence to give it.
And it's hard to distinguish now with regards to the image of the individual, whether it's a still photograph or a video, the sound of their voice itself. I understand that there was a recent scam using deepfakes in Hong Kong just this month, in fact, whereby an individual was duped out of handing over about $200 million worth of cryptocurrency as a result of having, it's my understanding, a Zoom meeting with five or six of his or her colleagues, and each person on that Zoom was a deepfake. And they actually handed over the cryptocurrency as a result of that. It's interesting if you go down a little deeper in this rabbit hole of, you know, nefarious behavior. People are talking about Elon Musk's one of his innovations, Neuralink, which is essentially their brain computer interface. And I realize that at the core, it's not about artificial intelligence, but perhaps you can explain a little bit what Neuralink is, and then what happens if that bad actor wants to use artificial intelligence across the people connected with Neuralink.
So
that's sci-fi to follow up stuff.
As to follow up on that Hong Kong story, I love it because I think it really paints a picture for what I would say is like what people should be aware of. If the, you know, audience members out there listening is like, oh, like, well, how should I sort of change my thought process around sort of being tricked scams? Because I think it used to be, hey, it's going to come in an email. And I'm going to be interacting with one person, the scammer. But that is no longer the case. You could actively be on a Zoom call with seven deepfakes where it's, you know, seven different people all, you know, talking as if they're real, but the voice sounds real, the image sounds real, and oh, the connection's a little blurry, the camera's a little blurry. But I don't think the average person would say, hey, yeah, seven people are going to spend an hour on a Zoom call with me having a corporate meeting to steal money from me. That was just, it's sort of absurd. But I think, you know, heading into election season, my sort of nightmare scenario is, okay, well, that's expensive to do, but that dude had, you know, millions in crypto. If I'm looking for someone's vote, I don't have to sort of have one person. I could say, make, you know, a new echo chamber in social media, and say, hey, you know, the nightmare scenario is like, hey, my parents are trying to understand a new topic, something emerging in technology that's scary, like AI. And they go online and they start interacting with it. And there are 10 people in a chat room or on some message board, and nine of them are bots. And they are the 10th. And they would never know. And that, like, that is that sort of dystopian to me is like, you'll never win an argument with a bot. You'll certainly never win it with nine. It is a war of attrition. They will just slowly push back. Slowly, you know, one will be aggressive and one will side with you, but then sort of, you know, walk you forward. Like, it, you can do a lot to manipulate people, particularly when they don't know they're being manipulated, and you crowd them out. And we are absolutely at that point in our technology. And I think the Zoom meeting is just like takes that example to an absurd level, but it happened. So we're going to have to deal with that. On the Neuralink side, I can't say I am a, you know, biologist or you know, a doctor in the space, but I do think that is interesting. There are a lot of ethical issues with how Neuralink has gotten to the point where it's at. I think, you know, maybe some, you know, some ethics review boards might have been you know, necessary. But Elon Musk is pushing boundaries. So the Neuralink, for the audience, as I understand it, right, he's putting called a small array of sensors in your brain. It's like a chip in your brain with some wires that sort of go around the brain. Typically, you see this in sort of people, you know, you sort of watching movies where people all have those little electrodes on their head, they're doing brain studies. Typically, those things are done on the outside of your brain, which is fine if you're just trying to do a sort of a passive interaction. But it's also, you know, it's sort of like trying to hear, you know, play a game of telephone with really complex, you know, really complex sentence. Someone's trying to tell you the sentence, but they're holding a pillow to their mouth. So, you know, trying to talk to your brain and read those sort of electrical pathways at sort of a fine granularity through your skull and hair is hard. So a lot of the research has actually been done on people who have had to have those inserts done in their brain for other reasons. So, hey, I am an epileptic and I've surgically had to have these implants done. And then they ask those epileptic patients to volunteer for other studies around these sort of neural linkages. It's sort of like, hey, you've already got the hardware, come do some research. And I think, as I understand, sort of Elon Musk is trying to commodify that technology might be the way. It's like, okay, well, how do I make it easy? You know, you can think of sort of the, you know, people got all those, like, I used to have to go to an orthodontist to get braces, and now I can get some of the, you know, Invisalign. It's like, hey, everyone can get these little plastic things. It's a medical device, but it's quick. It's easy to show up at our clinic and we mail it to you 2 weeks later. So I think Elon Musk is actually sort of trying to head towards that. I'm not sure what the output is, what the benefit is, because I don't think we've seen sort of like, hey, I can't like read digital information with my brain. But we don't know. The first step, however, is a large data set of people with these, you know, very, you know, embedded implants, not the sort of outside the skull. And there are some advances on the outside of the skull. There's, I think, a programmer who was playing Call of Duty with her head and just like a passive receiver. And she was just like thinking moves and sort of like nodding her head or moving her eyes, like very minimal movements. So like if someone's trapped in a wheelchair, like could this work? And yeah, she was playing Call of Duty and like, you know, actually killing other players. It was yeah, really impressive.
I think that's the essence of it, right? It's to commodify, right? It, but it's also, it allows for you to control a computer or to control a mobile device with your brain, right?
Right. And, you know, there is already that research being done in the medical community by medical experts with people who are, you know, who not sort of fully aware of the risks of that sort of procedure and are probably usually because the risks are so great relative to the benefit, they're only doing a sort of, hey, I've already got this disease. I already need the hardware for a medical issue, but yes, now you can do research. And I think trying to flip that to me is what worries me about Neuralink is it's pretending to be a value proposition that isn't really there yet, saying, hey, do this thing, it'll be great. I don't know how it'll be great. I don't have data to prove it'll be great. to get that data, I have to test on you specifically. That sort of ethical balance of like heavy surgery on your brain and like a potential benefit is I can move a mouse with my mind seems sort of like imbalanced, but he's heading into that.
It's interesting though, because it could, I think, deepen the digital divide between the haves and the have nots too. You could imagine that eventually if Neuralink is, you know, a fantastic technology and it's not as invasive as it sounds actually kind of horrific, frankly speaking, but if it's, you know, seamless integration into your body, a person with the benefit of Neuralink could be sitting in a board meeting with some peers that don't have access to a computer and in real time answer the questions. They could be looking to get a job that's worth a lot of money, and in an interview have access to that data and that information. I guess the scary part of it, beyond the obvious, the physical part of it, is if artificial intelligence is being used in a way that is nefarious, whether it's wrong messaging or a deep fake, a lot of people can end up having this information vis-a-vis Neuralink, I guess, put into their mind. But so, you know, it's an interesting place we're going, and it, you know, lends to the idea of, you know, whether or not we're going too fast with regards to building new technologies and artificial intelligence in particular. Right now, effective accelerationism is a big topic in the tech community. I think there's part of the argument, or a strong part of the EAC argument, is we need to accelerate to save humankind. And I'm wondering, in your opinion, should we lean into it and continue to accelerate this quickly? Or are we risking a situation with artificial general intelligence where, we're going to actually kill humankind?
Yeah. And I do want to clarify to the audience right now, like, as much as on the Neuralink, as much as we sort of talk about it, it is an outbound messaging. My brain can tell the chip something. The chip cannot tell my brain something. We are far from that. If you think of like, oh, I'm going to become Neo in the Matrix and get plugged in and you know, have all of Wikipedia at my fingertips, we are very far from that. Too bad. That'd be awesome. I would love to know Kung Fu. but the ability to sort of control devices and sort of outbound control, that is possible. But I'm more excited by sort of the AR and VR augmented reality sort of systems that get a little bit more fashion friendly. So instead of the big heavy Vision Pros that Apple puts out, but like more like the Facebook and Ray-Ban partnership, like, hey, I've got these glasses, which have microphones or sort of headphones sort of built in, sort of those jawbone skull things where there's no speaker, it's just resonating with your head. And it's got an AR display in the glasses, but it looks fashion forward. I think that sort of interface of receiving information and engaging is going to be much, much more common in the next 20 years. And that's the direction we're headed. And I think Neuralink is going to end up being more of a medical thing for a while. But the ability to sort of write electrodes into the brain to influence is, we're far from that. Even sort of chemically speaking, antidepressants are mostly just like chemical soup. We just throw it into the brain in a big soup. It's not targeted to specific regions or problems. It's soup.
So you think the first step then is like MR, AR, VR, Apple's Vision Pro, you think is a big step forward in that direction?
Yeah. What I liked about Apple's VR Pro is that they upped the game in terms of the sort of the quality to a sort of consumer threshold. I think Oculus was great. I think, Facebook Meta, it was an interesting play to sort of push towards the metaverse. I think maybe they're a little bit too far over their skis on that one, but it is coming. I think their partnership with Ray-Ban is a much better signal because hey, Ray-Ban is a known brand. It's fashion forward. And if you want to start having people sort of really use this, you can't be something big and heavy and clunky. And that's the big complaint with Apple Vision Pro right now. It's got to be more like, oh, I've got glasses. I think we're headed towards that. And just like I think the analog of Apple's iPhone, early first iPhone, like it couldn't copy and paste for 2 years. It seems sort of silly now, but that was the use case at the time. It got better. It got way better, even as bad as it was the first round. And Apple is a company that yes, they have some failures, but they know how to make things better if there's viability. So I do think we are headed towards the AR VR space, and that will crowd out sort of any benefit of Neuralink, because if I can get 90% of that value as a consumer and I don't have to have major surgery, I'm probably going to do that. We circle back on that. We were talking about, accelerationism. I like the idea of accelerationism in some contexts. Climate change, for example, I think accelerationism is the right path forward. But it's the right path forward because of the governmental construct that we're operating in, right? The world has not figured out how to get together and say, hey, stop producing so much fossil fuels. Let's all collaborate. We collaborate enough to talk about it. We're not collaborating enough to really do anything. We're doing something, but it's not nearly enough. It's not like we're producing less carbon. We're just producing more at a slower rate. So, we're still heading towards disaster, but a little bit slower. It's not a great sign for us as sort of a, our abilities to operate collectively. So I think my bet is, in fact, on technology in that space. I think that even like the patents that are coming out of sort of Shell and BP and, battery technologies, the large energy companies, while they are fossil fuel companies, they are hedging their bets and they're investing in non-fossil fuel energy systems. They want to be energy providers writ large and own that transition. And I think helping them, tax breaks, whatever, encouraging them to say, yes, go invest more, invest faster in this space is going to be better. The fact that we've got, all these electric car, grids, whether you like Tesla or not, the fact that they had a sort of charging grid set up, superchargers, it was a big step forward, and it really did sort of change the car industry.
It's incredible.
It didn't quite have the effect that we wanted, because the sort of the environmental impact of charging a car and producing that electricity is still worse. Running these AI fancy cars is still worse than a combustion engine in terms of total energy cost. And a lot of that electricity still produces carbon. So, but we're getting sort of the pieces in place. So in that context, climate change, geoengineering, even China starting to modify weather, at some point, I think the crisis and the weather events will get so terrifying and bad that countries, maybe not the US, but someone, you can imagine Indonesia, India, China, who are going to be much more dramatically impacted sooner by climate change and rising tides and bad weather, that they're going to act on their own, say, hey, I don't care what you guys think. I'm going to start cloud seeding. I'm going to start reflecting the sun. I can't deal with this. So I think there is that sort of potential unilateral action path, which, for better or for worse, it's nothing to do with US policy. It's just, what would I bet that someone else is going to do it? And acceleration in that sense, great. I'd rather that technology be good and faster and here and everyone actually sort of work on it together, than to pretend like we're going to survive. On the AI side, I have sort of the opposite. The issues of AI are, it's not like acceleration is going to solve a governmental problem. Issues of AI are actually going to exacerbate the government problem, sort of governance problem. If you think the biggest threat from AI is the loss of jobs, I think that is everyone sort of understand that. Oh, I had this knowledge worker job. Oh, I was an artist, and now an AI can do my work better than me. The joke, the joke I make is that, it's even coming for comedians, right? We are not far from a future where stand-up comedians are not as funny as the AI writing their jokes. And it's like, what's the point of being a stand-up comedian if an AI is funnier than you? All knowledge jobs are suspect. A lot of creative jobs are suspect. Music can be written by AI and sound like the artist. So if that is the context we're heading to, where the knowledge worker jobs, particularly the ones that the US has been sort of, this is our economy based on, so the knowledge workers, if those go away, our economic advantage goes away, and we sort of go back into a very fast era of sort of renewed globalization. And for those who sort of had jobs in the 90s and the early 2000s, when the internet, even sort of late 80s, when the internet was blowing up and jobs were getting offshored because they could, technology enabled offshoring, it didn't need to be physically present to do a lot of this stuff, that offshoring really disrupted industries in bad ways. And the problem wasn't that these AI tools were or these internet tools were bad, it was that the pace of change was faster than society's ability to sort of deal with the loss of income for all these people. It's not like I'm a mill worker and I can suddenly learn the internet and AI. It's not like, oh, I spent 20 years becoming a really, really good accountant and now an AI can do my job. I'm not going to then go, I'm going to go be a barista. Many people did end up having to do that. And that's a massive loss of income and our society wasn't really so structured well for that. And a lot of people lost out and we wave our flags like, hey, free market, this is better. But yes, we can say, hey, we're headed towards that. We do want to do that. But how do we do that in a way that is maybe a little less dramatically dangerous for our society? It drives fewer people into poverty. It maintains, revenue for school systems and all these things we sort of have structured into our system. We cannot have a capitalist system that says, hey, your ability to feed yourself is dependent on your job. And then be like, oh yeah, now we're going to release this technology that just destroys all these jobs and pretend like the two aren't related. We have to balance both. So I think there's sort of that accelerationism in AI, it is coming. And I think we need to maybe temper it. Let's learn the lesson from the 90s and say, hey, let's just go a little slower and think a little bit more cautiously about this. And the example I bring is, I think you and I were talking about this before. The term for people who hate technology is Luddite. And I love this, people pretend like, oh, accelerationism is this brand new thing. Lean in the future. I don't think, the Peter Thiel, whoever it is, I don't think they actually know what the future is. They're promising great things, but they don't know. They're betting. And he's a billionaire. He's going to be fine regardless. The rest of us, I don't know about. So I would give that accelerationism, they're betting on an unknown, and they're going to make out like bandits. We may not. So I'm a little scared in that respect, but they pretend like, oh, it's this brand new thing. Of course it'll be better. But if we look at all the history of humanity, actually we've done this a few times and it's failed in the 90s, but the original one was actually the story of the Luddites. And the term is now talk about sort of technology winning over. We refer to people who hate technology as Luddites, but that actually wasn't the Luddite movement originally. They were, wool weavers, loomers, right? And the mechanical sort of automated looms came out in England and were like, oh my God, my whole business, my livelihood, my family, my children will starve if these things go into production. And they said, hey, we know this is coming, but can you give us a little, can you give us a little bit of a social safety net? And this is sort of pre post-war socialism of the UK. This is sort of cutthroat capitalism UK. So they're protesting, hey, we need a little bit of help here to sort of transition. And the Parliament at the time was like, nope, best of luck, harsh free market capitalism. So these people went from like having a job and being able to feed their children to suddenly absolutely impoverished. And it was a whole industry. And these were parts in areas where like towns were built around an industry. So you had whole towns overnight suddenly impoverished. And those people got upset. And then they set fire to the factories or the looms. Maybe not the best idea, but I can understand it. Like, hey, like my children can starve or, I'm setting fire to this thing. The role of government in that space was like, this is where government failed to sort of deal with that transition. It's like, hey, we didn't need to burn down the factories. We could have actually found a soft landing for this group and still advanced our technology and our industry. And they pretended like, oh no, we're going to ignore it. And of course that led to violence, and deaths, I believe. So, we have failed at this many times before, and putting our blinders on to accelerationism, and the cost of that is where we fail. But I do think, the technology will come. We are moving forward. How fast we go and how deal with the consequences of that speed is the question, that I hope people start to think about.
James, just to play devil's advocate with you for a second, is it practical to believe that commercially our businesses here in the United States will slow down so that they could be more prudent in the way that you're talking about? And then on top of that, what happens with regards to influence? As you had said earlier in our discussion, effectively, the way that these LLMs are trained become knowledge sharing centers. So if we're not as a nation moving forward and putting the foot down, the gas pedal down as it relates to innovation, capitalism, specifically for AI, will that hurt us? Is it practical? And then also, will there be LLMs perhaps someplace else in the world that will have a different type of information sharing system that doesn't align maybe with American values or Americans' take on history? Who knows if it's right? But you know, these are issues that I think we would be looking at if we slow down. Is that a concern of yours?
Yes. And I think I would counter is that I'm not suggesting that we slow down. I'm suggesting that we acknowledge the cost of speed, saying, hey, you know, it's like, hey, it wasn't like, hey, don't build the looms, you know, let the Luddites be for a couple of years and then we'll slowly, you know, build looms. It's like, no, build the looms and then help the Luddites, you know, transition to prepare. New paths. Maybe prepare.
Right.
You know, like, and like we tried this a little bit in the 90s with job training. But it doesn't really work, right? It does, like, you can't be, you know, like a 20-year accountant and then suddenly learn, you know, like, yeah. Oh, I'm going to go to the mines.
Like, woman's going to drop out. Yeah.
Right. So, this was also sort of in the pandemic, like, there's this, you know, some people just couldn't deal with the transition to remote work and didn't want to. So, dropping out of the workforce when you are able bodied is a drag on the economy. So, like, even the, you know, small C conservative, most sort of fiscally conservative person in our country say, hey, we actually want greater GDP. We want people in our workforce. We want people with knowledge and skills to actually be engaged and spending money and making money and spending money. That is how our country stays ahead. So if we are going to say, yes, if trying to regulate and slow down industry, I think you pointed out, it's near impossible. You can put a little sand in the gears there, but not too much. You can't stop it. And I think you could look at the history of cryptography and internet security as like, nope, like it's gonna happen. The technology's out there, it's gonna happen. But we can at least sort of maybe offset that risk with sort of put my more progressive hat on, but this idea of maybe a little bit more of a social safety net for people impacted by this specific thing, and maybe AI is actually the solution to that. Think about sort of scaling and job programs and retraining and opportunities. I mean, a lot of people in the last, you know, financial crisis, whatever, you know, 2008, a lot of people lost jobs and like they didn't return to the original job. A lot of them, like, and you know, sort of the era of, I think, gig working sort of blew up in that ecosystem.
Yeah, they reinvented themselves.
It's like, I can't get a full-time job anymore because my industry doesn't exist. I guess I'll just drive my car around and get paid by the hour. So like it is, or by the ride. Probably not what people imagined when they got their degree and spent 5 years building a career. It's like, oh yeah, I want to be an Uber driver. How do we tap into people's excitement and potential and their existing experience in education in a way that is thoughtful and fruitful for society? I don't know, but I do think that if we're gonna start cutting jobs, we need to find ways to create more jobs for that audience that is not as far a leap from their existing skill set. Don't ask the accountant to become a barista if you want him to be happy, because he may be like, nope, I'd rather just retire.
But we've seen, like, historically with the advent of new technologies, we've seen job growth, we've seen job creation, new industries, new needs, as new demands come out of these innovations. I mean, certainly we saw it as it relates to the automotive industry when we moved from, you know, I remember reading recently a story here in New York City. People were up in arms because the addition of cars on the road were going to kill the very important and very popular hay industry that was all around New York City. I don't know if you're aware of this, but like people were really up in arms because of it. But sure enough, with automotive, more jobs came, different types of jobs that people didn't even imagine. And, you know, in a way, it certainly had a positive impact on GDP. And I think it also helped rise the quality of living, the standard of living on a local scale, for sure, in some ways, arguably. But, you know, access to better quality healthcare, better quality food, et cetera. I think if we can find ways to leverage this new technology, it could be very beneficial. You mentioned education. I think it's interesting to look at artificial intelligence impact on a global scale. I think there's going to be a certain level of rebalancing worldwide, right? Like, no longer, arguably, no longer does the individual who's working perhaps on a farm in Sri Lanka that wouldn't be able to access westernized university, Oxford and Harvard and even New York University, because it's very expensive to attend these universities. Well, now they could certainly just access their phone. Everybody has a mobile phone and receive education from artificial intelligence on a particular topic and, you know, take that concept a little further, maybe even be innovative and creative and start a business of her own or his own. How do you see artificial intelligence impacting, I think, the education structures that we have, the traditional westernized university education structures that we have? Do you think there'll be an international rebalancing?
Yeah. On the horse analogy, I love this one. It's not only the hay industry, it was the manure industry, which actually had it, because I think New York was producing 100,000 tons of horse poop a day in New York. So like the carts to move manure from the city to the farms was massive. It was like a huge industry. That was the one that actually, because it wasn't like, it was farms depended on that manure. But I will also argue that like that transition happened in an era when the US was sort of very sort of more ruthless capitalist, free market. It's like we didn't have a lot of job training programs. And like we could say, hey, yeah, we've got cars now. Yeah, cars survived. You know, the technology won out. I don't know if the people who had livelihoods and at the time that were ruined were so happy. But I also know that the speed with which the car took over was slow. It wasn't an overnight thing like AI. It was like because you have to manufacture cars, you had to train people, like only the wealthy could afford them. So it was a while, but from like the early car until like, you know, the Model T with Henry Ford. And even then, the price point had to come down. So there was, I think, a transition of at least one generation of the people who grew up I'm the son of a hay salesman, a manure. That job's dying out. I'm going to go get another one. There was sort of a generational gap. And that one generation gap is what's really required in these transitions.
It's a fascinating story. It's not told enough, in my opinion, as far as like history of America, as well as how it relates to the history of renewable energy. That first, those first cars that hit the streets in America were actually powered, as you're aware, they were electric powered. They were battery powered, and then we moved into fossil fuels, gasoline, oil later on. And it's funny how things come full circle. Now we're talking about Elon and Tesla and everything. But we're going back to where we started. We're going back. You know, it's back to the future, right?
Yeah, back to the future. Yes. So on the ed tech side, education side. So this is a passion space of mine. So my parents are both teachers, high school teachers, and I. Worked in the education AI space before this most recent wave of AI. And, begrudgingly, my investor said, I don't think online education or remote education is ever going to be a thing. Shut down that company like a couple months before the pandemic because couldn't convince investors that online education was really going to take off. And AI-based education was coming. So while I am, I think I have good foresight, apparently I'm not a great salesman. lessons learned there. But I absolutely do think that AI is going to shape the nature of education. I think that we've tried to do similar things in these fits and starts. There was a movement in the education space, the flipped classroom model. And basically, for those unfamiliar with it, the idea was teachers, like the sort of typical style of teaching for a long time was sort of the teacher is this bucket of knowledge. The kids all have heads that are empty buckets, and you pour a little bit. The teacher just pours a little bit in everybody's head, right? It's this dump of knowledge, and I'm sure a lot of people, sort of, our age or older, remember like, oh, you're sitting in classrooms, and the teacher writes a whole bunch of stuff on the board, and you just write it down, and like that was school. That structure is pretty terrible, pedagogically speaking. It doesn't lead to the best outcomes. So there has been sort of movement. It's like, oh, how do you make education more engaging? How do you make teachers more responsive to students' needs? And what online video, early sort of 2010s, online video comes out and says, hey, if all we're doing is standing up in front, if all the teachers are doing is standing up in front of a class and teaching kids, like it's just one way dump information, we could do that on video. And if, you know, like if we've got time with kids, that's precious. So let's record the videos, make watching the videos the homework. Go home, watch the lectures, then come to class, and we're just going to do all the interactive stuff. We're going to do the homework together and in small groups. So the engaging part, the hard part of like, oh, I've got to challenge myself, I've got to try, it's a lot easier because the teacher's there to help you. Like, oh, I don't get it. As opposed to just dump information, then you go home and you're stuck trying to do it by yourself.
So effectively and, more immersive and collaborative versus being spoken to.
Yes. And it, you can also see sort of like how a lot of the educational outcomes that, you know, we are dealing with today are based off of home life. And part of that is because the formative assessments, like think of it as like tests or quizzes that you take at home, not to get a grade, but to learn, right? It's the thing you struggle at so that you can actually learn and then take the summative assessment at the end. Like, hey, I proved that I learned it. So homework is basically just formative assessment. But the success at homework is this vehicle of learning. It really depends on a couple of things. Like, do you have a house or home life that enables you to do homework? Are your parents educated enough that they could help you with that homework? Because are they even around? The only people sort of there to help you at night with homework are the people in your house. Otherwise, you have to have, you know, afford a tutor, et cetera. So you can see this is where sort of finance and economic, you know, socioeconomic background and wealth predicts, you know, educational outcomes, because our education system was as dependent on, you know, educated parents or parents who can afford tutors, because a lot of the learning was done at home. So flipped classroom comes along and say, hey, watch the videos, do this classroom stuff, you know, like immersive stuff in the classroom. Love the idea. Problem was, teachers aren't really necessarily great at making videos. It's hard to track accountability on the video, so kids wouldn't actually watch them. So there's a lot of, we just didn't quite crack that sort of user experience nut for, you know, for student education. But I do think that the concept there was good, because I think it leads us into an AI future, right? Because I can imagine it's like, well, this movement was really rethinking how information gets translated to students, how often students get to sort of interact and iterate. Oh, I failed, but a teacher was right there to help me. And then I did it. I did the next version again. I didn't have to do homework, turn it in, wait 4 days to get it back and be like, oh, oops, I totally misunderstood this. So my sort of cycle of learning is not 5 days, it's, you know, minutes. And I think that is the power that AI can, you know, can sort of start to inject into our education system is, hey, as a student, I want to try this thing. And if I get it wrong, the AI can help me right then and there. What we have not cracked is the user experience is like, well, students, everybody's a little bit lazy. So why try, like, are we going to trust a student to watch the video with the classroom? Or are we going to trust a student now in the AI community or the AI sense? You know, don't ask the AI for the answer, ask it for help. And right now I suspect we're seeing a lot of students like, oh, I'm just asking the AI for answers. Like, hey, here, I'm just going to copy the whole question in, and it'll just tell me what to do. So there's an element of how we balance this of like show your work and be reflective. And we are now in a sort of an arms race with AI to sort of how we validate a student's learning and education. When homework, the struggle is sort of the point. So if we don't figure out how to sort of encourage students to struggle at something and not just take the quick way out, which at this point is AI, we're never really going to, I think we're going to see a sort of a real drop off in educational outcomes. I think it can be solved. We got to really reframe the whole home life, school life, the whole ecosystem has to change pretty radically if we're going to make sort of acknowledge the existence of the AI in the system now.
So there are a few entrepreneurs that I know that are using immersive experiences in the metaverse, VR specifically. There's a company, for example, I don't know if you're familiar with Optima Ed, but what they've done is they've recreated over 200 different experiences where students can now K through 12 join together with their professor on the moon, at the Boston Tea Party, at the Great Pyramids of Egypt, and go through several academic challenges. They need to like complete certain tasks with the professor. And what Stanford has found is that these immersive experiences increase the ability for the student to remember the lesson by as high as 75% to 80%, whereas reading or lecturing to a student, the memorability of that experience is down at about 5% to 10%. So I think this blending of perhaps spatial computing and virtual reality coupled with immersive educational formats with tasks built in. So the student has to go through to show that they've completed that history class or the math or science or whatever it might be, can, you know, be pretty much of a game changer. Pretty interesting. So what we do, we've had you for a long time, James, today, and I really appreciate it. But a tradition that I have with every single guest is I like to finish the show by setting up the beginning of a sentence, and my guest completes it. It ties back into the name of the show, some future day. So what I'd like to do is challenge you. I know this is just, you know, off the cuff, but I'd like to challenge you with the beginning of this sentence. Since we're talking about children and education, in some future day, artificial intelligence will provide my children with a world where?
A world where they can learn anything in a fun and engaging way and are then driven by their curiosity and excitement, which to me is the best way to learn anyway. So I think AI can get us there. Those immersive experiences you were talking about, I think that is the vision I hope for.
Awesome. James, is there anything else that you'd like to add before we sign off here today?
I don't think so. Thank you so much for having me on this episode and this podcast. I really enjoyed this conversation. We went a lot of different places, but it's always fun to sort of tackle this. And I think for all those out in the audience who sort of interested in the AI space and want to learn more, it is, I think, one of the things that I would recognize is that AI is not a technology at this point, and most people are not experienced it. Like, they're not going to be coding AI. They're going to be seeing it sort of get its fingers in every little bit of their life. So just keep an eye out. Just look around you, start to sort of acknowledge it, see what it can and cannot do, and just be cognizant and versed in using AI as a consumer. And if you do that, I think you'll be more prepared for the big changes that are coming, because you'll sort of understand where it works really well and where it doesn't, because you've tried it. Don't be afraid to just try it. Don't be afraid to sort of log into some of these tools and give it a go. I think everyone will be surprised, delighted, confused, but everyone will learn. And that is, I think, the point. So
dip your toe into the AI pool. James, thank you so much. It's really been amazing speaking with you today.
Yeah, thank you so much.
I know your time is very important, so thank you so much for joining me today. For ongoing insight surrounding these important topics, you can join the conversation on my social media channels, including Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn, at Mark Beckman. And to sign up for my newsletter on Substack, you can find me at markbeckman.substack.com. To make sure you don't miss a show, be sure to subscribe to Some Future Day across all major platforms worldwide, including YouTube, Spotify, and Apple. Special thanks to New York University for producing Some Future Day, and a big shout out to my producer extraordinaire, John Boomhoffer, for being patient and always encouraging me to push through. Thanks a lot, John. Have a great day.